Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, merchandise, an archive of past episodes and information on how you can help keep this podcast running. That's fyrgen.com. Hello again, friends, and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan, and this episode I'm joined by a man named Noah Rivoy. Noah is an author, a coach, and a mentor, currently living in Portugal, but originally from Canada. I've been speaking to several people behind the scenes about doing an episode about the female role in family and society, and that's something that I'm working on, and in probably the next five episodes, you'll see something like that. But for this episode, we'll be largely focusing upon the male role in society. And that's partly because Noah has a distinct background in what has been termed the manosphere. Noah's work is something I've been familiar with for a number of years, mainly through our mutual friend, Hadron, who has appeared on the Fergan podcast a couple of times, offering her astute insights. And really what Noah and I wanted to tackle in this episode, I think it's of vital importance really, is the current psychological state of Western man. And we're going to be coming at that topic from a couple of different angles. But Noah, good to be speaking with you and welcome to the Fergan.
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh yeah, you're very welcome. You've been knocking around, as we say in England, for a number of years, quite a few years. You've spoken at conferences. You have been on countless live streams, podcasts. You have your website, noahrevoy.com. That's N-O-A-H-R-E-V-O-Y.com. And you now have a reputation as a coach. I mean, most people would kind of call it life coaching, I guess, but that I don't know. I'm always reluctant to use the term life coaching because it seems kind of I don't know. What do you think about that term?
Sounds very new agey.
Yeah, exactly.
There's not really a name for what we're doing as coaches. It's mostly to differentiate us from things like therapy. You know, therapy is there to help fix broken people, and there is a need for that. But most people aren't broken. Very, very few people are broken. They're incomplete. And coaching helps you become complete, helps you fill in any gaps in your knowledge, your skill set, and your abilities. And that's why it's different. And we use a different word for it. And I think the reason it's so hard is because we didn't used to have this. Mentoring, okay, that's ancient. That's an ancient concept because we always had mentors. We would have our father, but we usually had some other male mentors as well. If you read Marcus Aurelius, he talks about his mother being a mentor as well, but him having teachers that were vastly important to his ability to develop his thinking and his maturity and to really become the man that he was. So this concept is ancient, but the coaching is new. It's to fill a gap created by fatherlessness, by a society where all of our institutions have been undermined. And so they're not providing the mindfulness that we used to get. You can't even go to church anymore and get mindfulness or any kind of, this is right and this is wrong. It's rainbow people and singing and dancing, and it's turned into basically a circus. And so young men and young women are looking for somewhere where they can get feedback. What am I missing? Like a client told me recently, I know that I'm missing things in my development as an adult. And at this age, I'm embarrassed to even ask what they are. And so that's where people are stuck. And you can come to a coach and find out what you're missing and fill those gaps in.
Yeah, I think traditionally the concept of a teacher was a lot more complete than it is today. You know, when we think of a modern teacher now is someone who you send your kids to school, that teacher specializes in a particular subject, relays certain information pertaining to that subject to your child, and they come home and they talk about what their teacher told them. Whereas I think historically a teacher was not just a teacher of facts and figures, but also a mentor, a guide, and also someone who just kind of had your back, someone who was had your best interests at heart. And I don't think we can really say that about modern school teachers. You know, they are literally just doing a job, and yeah, they've got certain targets to hit. They want a certain numbers of their pupils to hit those targets to get good enough grades or whatever, and maybe they get a bonus at the end of it. But not many teachers, it seems to me, have a kind of vested emotional interest in the development of that particular human being, or a, you know, a set number of human beings. So yeah, I think the coaching that you do, it fills that, it makes it kind of completes the picture of a teacher. It's that missing element, because, you know, as so many of us, you know, I homeschool, some of the listeners I know homeschool as well, and one of the reasons that I do that is because I don't want my children to learn about this period of history or algebra or you know, chemistry or whatever. I also want them to learn how to grow their own food, how to you know, make a simple shelf or put up a shelf, you know, basic DIY skills. So those are the aspects of teaching that we kind of no longer have today. But there's also that psychological, emotional, spiritual aspect of teaching, which I think that I would say, from what I know of your work, is what you bring to the table. And, you know, as you say, it's not so much kind of being able to give that person all of the answers, but it's being able to help them understand what they're missing, and being like a sounding board as well. I mean, would you agree that the work, you know, you yourself, you're learning from your clients in the same way that they're learning from you? Obviously, you have experience in dealing with certain issues, the ones that you specialize in. That's why they come to you. But every client you have, you're learning something from them, right?
Absolutely. This is why I evolve over time, and some of the advice I give evolves over time. And I've had some people I've coached that were really good at giving me feedback. And they were able to, some of them I've even trained to be coaches themselves. And some of the feedback they gave me, I'll give you an example, is I made the mistake that many of us make in assuming other people are more like us than they actually are. And so I'm very conscientiousness driven, and I'm driven, I'm quite ambitious in, you know, ambition plays in different ways. A lot of people think that's about money or power. It can be, it's really drive to accomplish whatever it is you want to accomplish. So I'm very ambitious in that way. I have a drive to accomplish things, and I have certain aspects to me that make me make different decisions than your average person. And I used to make this mistake of thinking other people can do what I can do, because if I can do it, they can do it. And that's not true. We have to approach each individual based on what it is that is their potential. We have to help them reach their potential, not ours. And this is very early on something that I learned. So we are constantly learning by coaching. We learn the same way that clients learn. You know, people learn by doing things. We don't learn well from books. We don't, you know, I've written books. I don't write them so that the person learns from the book to do it. I say in the book, you need to now take this out and apply it. And it's the application that makes you learn, not the reading in the book. That just gives you information. You didn't learn anything until you apply it. And it's the same with the coaching. Until you've coached, you don't get those skills. Like, you don't get them first and then coach. It's the other way around. First you start coaching and then the skills come.
Yeah. I mean, since doing this podcast, and this podcast has been going for sort of nearly a year now, I've learned a lot more, not just about the subject matters that I'm discussing, which mainly surround heathenry and paganism. I've learned a lot more talking about it, researching it, talking to others about it, and being forced to relay that information verbally in the way that you do on a podcast than I have in reading books. It's kind of sped up my learning process. But I've also learned a lot more about myself, because I never anticipated, you know, years ago that I would ever be hosting a podcast. It was never an ambition of mine, but several people encouraged me to do it. I think it's kind of putting anything into practice, whether it be coaching, whether it be hosting a podcast, whether it be playing music. You know, you can read all the music theory you want, but until you get on stage and actually perform it, you know, there's a very different experience and lesson in actually performing it than there is in knowing the theory of it. So your background, you kind of have this background, and, you know, the first appearances that I saw of you were, you were discussing this, you know, it was the manosphere, this idea about this, I don't mean to kind of lump you in with the movement, but I think it's worth mentioning MGTOW, the men go there, going your own way thing, which I remember from years ago was a big thing. It blew up very quickly. There was this whole movement of guys who kind of, it was a reaction to feminism, and I always thought it was a very understandable reaction. But yeah, some of the guys in that movement seemed to be pretty kind of toxic and psychologically flawed themselves. But the manosphere is a different thing. I mean, this is the idea that men should be restored to their rightful place as the head of a household, the heads of society, in the same way that's always been traditional within Western society. So what's your background like? How did you kind of find your feet with the manosphere? What's your relationship to it now? You know, how's that changed?
Yeah, I think the manosphere really is in general a reaction to what's happened since World War II, where there's been a strong undermining of Western masculinity in men. And this always happens. This is not a new thing. You know, that old saying that weak men create hard times create strong men create good times, which then create weak men again. Well, that good times that create weak men, that cycle is the undermining of masculinity. And this is not the first time it happened, but there are new tools available to those who would undermine masculinity that didn't exist in the past. And so they've done generations worth of destruction in a very short period of time. And they've done it to an extent which perhaps is unprecedented in history. I think we have the most effeminate society that has ever existed, because any society this effeminate in the past would have been instantly wiped out of disgust by its neighbors. And so, and it often happened in one area or the other where masculinity would be undermined, not worldwide, across the entire Western world, it's being undermined. And so there's this reaction, and some of that reaction is rational because it comes from rational people. And some of that reaction is irrational because it's irrational men reacting to a situation. Now, on top of that, the manosphere has been identified as a potential threat to the global powers that want to create they want to mush us all together, because how can you know, manosphere, how can you represent one group, or how can you say, I don't agree with the current thing, and not be a threat to them? And so what they do with that is they'll look at groups like MGTOW and they'll say, let's encourage the insane people. Let's give them some spotlight. And then they don't have to destroy it. The group destroys itself. This is a pattern. This is well known to anybody that understands how intelligence agencies work. They work almost purely through undermining. They get the group to cannibalize and destroy itself. And they'll do this with every part of the manosphere. And the FBI even recently basically called the manosphere a terrorist organization. It's not an organization. And not everyone agrees with each other. What you can do if you're interested in the manosphere in order to weed out the crazies is look for the people that are giving solutions and stick with them. So if someone brings up a problem, says there's a problem, this is how we got here, and this is what we can do to solve it, they're probably not a problem. It's the complainers that whine incessantly about women and the courts and every other problem that's in society. Those are the ones that are there to undermine. So undermining, they're being negative, they're undermining the foundations of society and not replacing it with anything, because they don't have answers.
Yeah. Well,
they're just there to complain.
All of the advice you've just given in the last couple of minutes applies not just to the manosphere and the movement to restore masculinity, but it applies across various of the kind of, you know, discontented, you know, from the idea of restoring nations in general, of, you know, traditional values, of even religion. And, you know, I myself am getting pretty sick of people who complain incessantly but don't offer any solutions. So I'm really trying with the Fergan to focus on solutions and to host people who are able to offer solutions. And that is one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on as a guest on this.
Thank you.
But, you know, you mentioned about men having become more effeminate or emasculated in modern times to a frightening degree. And one of the things that I've noticed since being a father, and my oldest child is 9. So obviously I've been a father for, well, 10 years really. And one of the things that I've noticed since becoming a father particularly is, when you become a father, you start taking your child to family events like petting zoos and things like that, you know. And you go to these places and you start to notice that the other fathers that are there tend to be extremely effeminate. And it struck me that actually, for the most part, I would say, we've got a situation now where the most effeminate men are the fathers. And those who haven't become fathers yet tend to be the more masculine ones, or rather, the few masculine men that we do have left tend not to become fathers or become fathers quite late. Obviously there are exceptions, yourself, and hopefully I'd include myself in that as well. But what do you think about that? I mean, have you noticed this trend of fathers, particularly of young children, the way that they'll speak to their child, the way that the mother is able to hand the pram to the father at any moment that she wishes, things like that. You know, obviously I'm not saying that a father shouldn't do his share of the parenting duties, but it just seems to me that very, very weak men tend to become fathers in modern times.
Well, it's interesting. They're fathers, but really they're second mothers. what's happening is that these men, and I'm using the term loosely, these they're immature males, and they're out there. Perhaps they look a little more masculine, or they're trying because they're womanless or with a bunch of guys. Men in a group alone without women become more masculine through inner male competition. So experience is what makes you more masculine, because masculinity is male maturity, and maturity comes through experience. And so a group of men by themselves will tend towards masculinization. Then a woman enters the group, and immediately the group starts to become more feminine. And that's a historical norm that always happens. That's why women were excluded from certain male-only fraternities, was to keep them masculine. Now, what happens is these guys, they get a woman that's, you know, she's in her 30s, career woman. She's like, I need a sperm donor, but, you know, I really could use some help babysitting. So I think I'm going to get like a live-in sperm donor. And they go and they pick some guy who's looking for another mommy, and she's the mommy to him as well. You know, and he's kind of like second mommy and she's first mommy. And they create this strange family.
And there probably isn't really any genuine love or romance involved between the two parents.
No, they're both getting their needs met, and the needs that they're getting met are pathological needs, not the normal healthy needs that a properly married couple gets. And the reason I think that it's been so easy to trick young people into things like the trans agenda is because these kind of families have such a screwed up sexual dynamic within them that there's no identity there. If you're a boy, what does that mean? Doesn't mean anything. My dad's a man, and you know, he's more effeminate than my mother is, type thing. So these kids are easy to be fooled because they have no clear identities or role models in which they can fit, because that's what children do. They fit to a certain role model. Yeah, they have tendencies, but they need role models to know what to do with those tendencies. And they're not getting that. And it's, it is quite common. I'm fortunate where I live that on average, the men are fairly masculine. They are very, it is a gentle culture. Portuguese are a gentle people. Unless you read about, you know, their discoveries around the world. Land on a place, kill everybody. It's ours now. You know, they were pretty rough back then, but nowadays they tend to be a very gentle people. But there is a certain masculinity towards men that men have here, and a femininity with the women, where roles are still there. But across the Anglosphere, it's been decimated. You're almost punished for being masculine. So, if you're in school.
Yeah, I agree. So what would increased masculinity look like, particularly in the context of a marriage or, you know, a young family, you know, parents with a child? What would, you know, compared to what we see with most, as you say, you know, living sperm donors, what would a more masculine father look like in comparison to that less masculine one?
So masculinity is male maturity, and this, the mature man in a family, he leads. That means he doesn't wait for the mother to initiate the things that need to be done for the family, mm-hmm. decisions that need to be made, changes that need to be made to how the family is running, whatever it happens to be. He's the one initiating these things. Leading doesn't mean you do all the work. It just means you initiate, you set the pattern for how the family should be. Let's pick an example, fitness.
Basically making decisions, yeah.
Yes, a decision. Let's pick an area of fitness. If you're a man and you're leading your family in fitness, then you're the one that's taking it more seriously than anyone else. Mm-hmm. A lot of guys complain, I take my fitness so much more seriously and the others don't. It's like, Dad, that's how it works. You're going to take these things more seriously. Usually that means the man makes more money. You know, nowadays you never know. But he's adding more value. He's always adding more direct value. The reason is the woman's job isn't to add value to the family. It's to transform value.
Mm.
So the man brings home money. She transforms that into food and a home and all the other things that are needed. She's transforming. He's gathering in that money. He's bringing it in.
Yeah. One of the things that I've tried to focus on since becoming a father, you know, I have three children now, and they're all daughters. I've got three daughters. So for me, you know, I've kind of asked myself over the years, how do I exert my fatherliness, my masculinity in a household of three daughters? And the conclusion I came to is that I need to make sure that, well, firstly, I need to realize that the man that my daughters end up marrying one day will probably be a reflection of who I am. You know, they're looking to me. I am essentially the blueprint for what an ideal father is going to be for them. So if I'm not an upstanding example of a good, honorable, masculine man, then they probably won't marry good, upstanding, masculine men themselves. And, you know, particularly with my heathen religious beliefs and the ancestor worship that comes with that, I'm very mindful of my descendants and what they're going to be like, what they're going to look like, how they're going to act, what their identity is going to be, these kinds of things. So it's important to me to know that a few generations down the line, when I'm dead and buried, that I have set a good pattern for what is to come. So the thing that I focus on most is being an example. So even though it can sometimes be difficult, and the fathers out there will probably sympathize with this, you know, when you're earning the money, when you're trying to spend time with your family, with your wife and your children as well, you're doing all your other chores as well, running a podcast, whatever else you're doing, it can be difficult to find time for physical fitness. But it's something that I've never let up. A couple of reasons for that is because, firstly, I know that it will help to maintain healthy testosterone levels as I grow old. You know, I'm nearly 40 now, so I need to be quite mindful of that. Secondly, I want to physically be a good example of a man, you know, as best as I can be, because I want my daughters to see me and think, right, to not want to settle for less when they come to find a man in the future. And this isn't to try and suggest that every child has some kind of romantic, every daughter has some kind of romantic sexual connection with their father. That's not the case at all. But as a father, you have to realize that you are the first example of a father and a husband that your daughter sees. So yeah, that's the way that I've gone about that. And hopefully it pays off in the future. But yeah, I mean, it is important. It is important to be a good example. And those less masculine, effeminate men that you see with children who have got their kind of, you know, their man boobs and their beer gut and whatever, and you know, I don't know whatever else, the way they dress as well, I just look at them and I feel sorry for their children, because I think what you've not really got anything to grow up to and emulate there. If they've got a young son, what example is being set for that son? If they've got a daughter, what kind of man is that daughter going to marry? And I think actually we're probably already seeing that. We're seeing the result now of previous generations of Gen Xers and Boomers having behaved in this way, and their children now are seeking out fathers which resemble those less masculine men from previous generations.
Yeah, absolutely. And you want your son, for example, to be proud of you. Like my boy, he's 9 years old. My oldest one, I got a 9-year-old and a couple of 3-year-old twin boys. 9-year-old comes to me and he says, "Dad," and he's pointing at a picture of a bear, and he says, "Do you think you could beat a bear in a fight?" And, when your kid's 9, you tell him, yes, of course I can beat a bear in a fight. Because they'll figure it out eventually that's not humanly possible, but they want the very idea they would ask that question is flattering. It shows that they consider you to be strong.
Yeah.
They look up to you. They want to be like you. My son gets up every day to go to school. Not today, because he wasn't feeling very well, but no, almost every day he gets up, he works out for 20 minutes. Then he reads a book. Right now he's reading The Way of Men by Jack Donovan. And then he eats his breakfast and goes to school. And I didn't tell him he had to do that. I was working out and I said, "Hey, you want to come work out with me each day?" I would do it during the times he was with us at home before he started going to school. And he would say, "Yeah, that sounds like fun." Now he wants to work out before he goes to school, so he's got more energy. And he decided on his own, "I guess I'll do it before I eat breakfast, because I can't do it after, because it's, don't want to work out in a full stomach." He does quite a complex workout routine. He's doing 50 push-ups, 50 kettlebell swings, 50 overhead presses, and all this other things that he's doing, 50 sit-ups, all of that. And he does that every single day on his own. He turns on some Sabbath and some loud music, does that.
Great. Yeah.
Gets the music going, does it, feels like $1 million, and he goes off to school. No one's going to bully him. No one's going to be able to bully him. And even if they do, he knows he can come back home and tell me about it. He knows. My dad was also very physically fit. And I remember when adults would try to mess with me or my brothers, everyone knew in our neighborhood, knew my dad, knew he was a dangerous man, and people would mess with us. And I'd say, "I don't think you want to do that. Do you know who my father is?" And they would think about it and they go, "Oh, okay. I'm not going to mess with these kids." The guy who was molesting kids at the school that I grew up in, I remember one time he looked at me and he goes, "Oh, wait a minute. I know who your dad is." And that's the only interaction I ever had with him. And he stayed as far away as he could from me after that.
He was known for molesting kids.
Yes, he was the school janitor. Yeah, it was. He got found out, I think, the last year that I was in that school. Yeah. And nobody did anything about it. But I didn't have to worry about it because people knew who my dad was. And my dad, every year, first day of school, would come in after working out in a muscle shirt, would have a calm conversation with the teacher and say, "If you mess with my kid, I'll kill you."
Nice.
and the teacher would be like, "Okay, I got the message. I never had any problems." He said, "On the other hand, if you have a problem with my son, you tell me and I'll straighten it out with him."
Yeah, that's the right attitude. That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's great. It's wonderful to think of men like that, and there are so few in the kind of current generation, which is tragic. I mean, my father, I think, is he was never into physical fitness, but he was always had a bit of a temper, but in a good way, not in a way that he'd take it out on myself and my brothers. But I remember one time I got beat up. I was about 12 or 13 years old, I think. I got beat up by 4 kids who surrounded me, demanding that I buy them some cigarettes. And when I refused, then they did their best to beat me up. I came out pretty unscathed considering, but, my dad, when I came home, he grabbed a baseball bat and was about to go marching out to get them. But then I informed him that they'd no longer be there because, they were catching the bus back from school or something like that. But yeah, I mean, that is what's missing. And it's hard to imagine many men of the current generation, many fathers behaving in such a way. And it's, as you say, it's because it's been psychologically, I would say beaten out of us, but that's kind of the wrong terminology. It's been kind of psychologically eased out of men of the current generation that violence is ever an acceptable solution to a problem, when it quite clearly is. You know, I mean, if that janitor had ever messed with you, then as far as I'm concerned, your dad would have had the right to beat him to whatever extremity he felt was suitable at the time.
Well, people complain all the time about, you know, the law is this, the law is that. They're saying this, and I'm thinking to myself, I don't care what the law says. You know, there's a point where you have to work within the law. And then there's a point where, you know, when the laws are no longer just, you have to work around them. Everybody knows this. Every single group knows this. In the UK, there are various groups that work completely around the law, and they get whatever they want. The more you're afraid of the law, the more you'll get abused by it, because it's a tool that, oh, you're afraid of this. Well, let me use this then to clobber you. Whereas if you're not afraid of it, then it doesn't work. And men have become afraid of everything. Yeah. You know, there are still men out there willing to go to jail if necessary to keep their kids safe. And then there's all kinds of men out there that aren't. You know, there are men that are willing to do whatever it takes to keep their community safe. Most men aren't. And the few men that are left, they're looking around going, you know, is it really worth it defending this entire community of cowards? What am I defending here? And so that's why you see a lot of these kind of men banding together and leaving society. And it's kind of John Galt, Galt's Gulch type situation, where they're leaving society. They're getting together with each other and saying, we'll defend each other. We're not defending these masses of cowards. And that's why they undermined masculinity. It's not that they hate men or want to get rid of us. It's that they want to enslave us. They love our masculine creativity if it makes them money. They love our masculine aggression if it helps them build an empire in the Middle East or wherever else they're empire building at the moment. What they don't want is it ever getting turned against them.
Yeah.
And that's why we've been undermined.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I've got a few friends, or I've had many friends over the years, who are proud of the fact that they've never thrown a punch. They've never been hit themselves. They're, you know, they're really proud of this fact. And I just think it's strange, because I kind of feel like, you know, I don't know how old you are, but I kind of feel like I'm from the last generation which actively kind of sought some kind of rite of passage as a young man. You kind of felt like if you got out of your teens without having been in a fight, you kind of felt like you were a loser, you know.
You missed out on something.
Yeah, you missed out on something. And it wasn't that you wanted to hurt people. It wasn't that you know, even that you felt that it was particularly cool. It was just kind of like, you know, this is what men do. Like if you've never had to deal with physical confrontation, can you really call yourself a man? I mean, you know, that's the kind of mentality that I grew up with. And I think not long after that, you know, those who are just 10 years younger than me, I don't think that same mindset exists anymore. And it's pretty sad to think about that, because not even because I want to see young men fighting one another constantly, but because it's more about the psychological condition of knowing that you can cope in some kind of physical confrontation. So that if you are, if the state does infringe on your rights in a way that you think is completely unacceptable and that you are willing to go to prison for, then you will step up and deal with that situation the way that a man should deal with that situation. You know, it's kind of like a test to see if you have that ability in you in the future to deal with a physical confrontation or not. And you can't know whether you have that in you or not until you've tested it at a young age, right?
Yeah, I'm 44. And when I was in grade six, I remember the principal coming to me and saying, came to me in particular because I was in a fight pretty much every day. So he came to me and said, oh, we've got this new mandated zero tolerance policy thing. It's stupid. He says that anyone who gets in a fight gets suspended. Doesn't matter if you started or not. He says it's coming everywhere. It's all across Canada now. He says, but you know what? He says, I think it's retarded. No, he didn't say that. He said, I think it's dumb. He says, I'm not going to implement it here. He says, I'll implement it for the younger kids. But he said, I'm going to grandfather you guys in. You know, try not to get in any fights. But if you do, you know, look, I'll try to look the other way and, you know, he'll get in too much trouble and, you know, ignore it basically. You know, we at that age, we were getting in fights that were sending people to the hospital. Like it was a really rough neighborhood. And he knew I wasn't starting them. But I couldn't stand to see small kids get beat up. You know, if they were being mouthy and stupid and they got smacked, that's, you know, that's the results of your stupid action. But they would just beat up random kids for no reason. And I couldn't stand that. So I actually organized a group of kids and we formed our own gang. We had, I've been reading about pirates and how they form their constitutions. So we formed our own constitution rules. You know, if you show cowardice, like if you're called to a fight and you don't show up, we beat you up, all that kind of stuff. So we had our own little system going. And that year we completely pacified the school. There was no more bullying. The older kids who came to the school, couldn't bully us from other schools. We actually drove that janitor pedophile out of the school. They had to get rid of him because we almost killed him. So they had to get rid of him. And so this guy, I don't want to say too much about those details. I think it's past the statute of limitations. But anyway, we got rid of him. They made him go away because of what happened. And so we completely cleaned up the school. And this taught me that you can't rely on the system to solve your problems. But you get a bunch of young boys together with proper leadership, young boys, not even men, and you can solve a lot of problems that adults don't want to solve.
Yeah.
And this informed my entire way of thinking about the world after that. I often say that the most important thing I learned in school was how to form a gang. Everything else I learned, I could have learned at home with books.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to say that I my upbringing wasn't nearly as kind of violent as that. You know, I had a couple of fights here and there. It was mostly after I left school. But it does sound like you got a lot from that. But why is it you think that what happens between, you know, school age boys and adults in the modern age that makes adult men not want to deal with situations violently, whereas teenage boys instinctively do want to, you know, see the worth in using violence, and obviously to great effect, as you just said. You know, you totally kind of pacified the school through these actions, and it can have that effect. But what is it precisely that you think happens to men at a certain point that makes them reluctant to use violence?
There's a reason why militaries around the world prefer to recruit teens starting at 17, 18 years old, and they don't want to recruit people in their early 20s, is because when you're 18 years old, you're at your peak of your testosterone, and you've got nothing to lose.
That's true, isn't it?
And you want to fight. Like once you start doing it, it becomes fun, and you enjoy it, and you want to fight. And so they're going to take that interest that you have, and they're going to weaponize it. Well, the problem is that they castrate you so quickly after that the testosterone levels in men now, you get 21-year-old guys, they have the testosterone of a 70-year-old grandfather. You know, my dad's dad, my grandfather, up until his late 70s, he was still hard as a rock. You know, his whole body, he didn't look very strong until you'd see him lift this massive rock out of his garden and, you know, toss it to the side like nothing. My dad, who was incredibly strong, he said one time to my grandpa, he says, punch me in the stomach. My grandpa was about 70 at the time. My dad was trying to show how hard his stomach was. He punched my dad. My dad's been in many hundreds of fights. And he said, I've never been hit that hard in my entire life. He said, I didn't realize you were that strong. It's the only time I'd ever seen my dad. I'd seen some pretty big guys at the gym punch my dad in the gut and can just laugh it off. And it's the only time that I'd seen him like lose some of his air out of it. But young guys today, they're like old men.
Yeah.
And they're old men because it's, yeah, maybe it's some estrogen in the atmosphere and some stuff and diet problems. All of those are symptoms of the fact that they're emotionally and spiritually castrated.
Yeah.
And the rest is just a result, just symptoms.
I remember when I first started lifting weights, I think I was 18 or 19 when I first started hitting the gym. You know, I was a skinny little guy. I was like 11 stone or something like that. And, you know, it took me a few years and I put on, you know, I got quite into bodybuilding at one point. And those who know what I look like now might be a little bit surprised because I'm not a particularly big guy now, but at one point I was up at 15 stone. And, but I remember a lot of the time you'd be at the gym and an old guy would walk in, a kind of a frail looking old guy would come in and he'd put like, you know, 100 kilograms on the bench press and bench press it. And you'd be like, holy shit, where did that come from? You know, but there, and I think you realize it as you get older as well, because even though I've lost a lot of my size, I haven't lost the strength that I had. And so you do realize that there is a big difference between strength and size. Yeah. And you do get these old men who still have the strength, even if they don't have the size. Maybe they never even did have the size, you know.
Yeah, our ancestors would have been strong, but quite lean because there wasn't an excess of food. You know, I was trying to gain some muscle in the last few weeks. And so basically eat an extra meal every day. And it's a lot of work to eat all those extra calories. Yeah. But yeah, you can gain that weight pretty quickly without changing your exercise at all. As soon as you stop, though, it goes right back to where it was. And, you know, our ancestors had no excess of food. If they had excess of food, they'd make more kids rather than get big.
Yeah, right.
How much food have I got? So many kids I'm going to make. And yeah. So they'd spend it in a different way. But yeah, no, young men, because they are they're spiritually and emotionally and mentally castrated, they're making decisions which cause their testosterone to lower. They believe themselves to all be losers. And because of that, they behave as a loser, which lowers their testosterone. Testosterone is largely the result of our psychology, not just the result of our physiology. And that's hugely underestimated. And you know, if you look at all the popular entertainment, it's all designed to emasculate men. And if you watch that long enough, it brainwashes you and you start acting like, I call them the castrati. That's the, you know, the singers that were castrated. This is what we've got now. We've got this nation of this, well, across the Anglosphere, these castrati, these young men that are basically eunuchs. And they're, of course, their testosterone is going to be low.
Yeah. And part of this is because there is no requirement for it anymore from all directions. So from women no longer seem to covet masculine men. So what reason?
Well,
do men
have? They say that. Okay. I'm 44 years old and I can't sit at a park bench without being harassed by younger women who are very, very forward. And I'm in a very conservative country.
Right. Yeah.
And they'll sit down and they'll basically tell me guys my age are losers. They live at home with their mom. They're not men. And I'm cool with being woman number two if it means at least I'm with a masculine guy a few days a week. They prefer that than be with any of the guys they're with.
Okay.
You know,
the
rate of young men and even young women having sex has dropped tremendously because women are just like, none of these guys are attractive. And a lot of women aren't as well, but it's mutual there.
So
there are still plenty of women out there that would make good wives and not enough men for them.
Yeah. So maybe it's more a case of the standards of both dropping. You know, women kind of think that they, either women think that there are no masculine men left, or they think that it's wrong to favor the masculine men or whatever.
Yeah.
And as a result, you do just tend to get these pairings of, you know, thinking about a lot of the people I know are very non-masculine men with, you know, just kind of typical women who they seem to be kind of attracted to one another and everything like that. But there doesn't seem to be any desire among those women for their partner to be any more masculine than he currently is. Maybe I've mistaken that as a desire for a less masculine man when actually they've just kind of settled for a less masculine man.
Yeah, they've settled and they're so bitter about it that they they hate the guy now. I mean, this is what I know. I coach people. I know I talk to people about what's really happening behind the scenes. I often talk to the guys and help them get out of this and fix it, you know, and stop being that beta loser. The women, you can't go by what you can't go by what women say, what they want. Okay. Women will pick that man because their drive to have children exceeds their drive to have the best man that they can find. And they desperately want children. And everybody understands that the system we're in is collapsing. And, you know, there will be no, your children are your only retirement option. There isn't anything else. And it's going to collapse sometime in our lifetime. Yeah. And everybody knows that. And they're all like, you know, everybody's seen their aunt that never, their wine aunt that never had kids, and they know how depressed she is. Like, I don't want to be stuck there. This 27-year-old girl told me last month, I just want to have kids and, you know, be at home with kids and a husband. I don't want to be out working. She says, my mom got completely fooled into 40-hour work weeks and looking after kids. And she's miserable. She says, I don't want that. I want what my grandma had. She says, who wants her grandma's deal back? And it is not these women, these young women's fault that deal kind of got taken off the table. Their mothers hadn't have accepted it, it never would have become a thing. Men's wages would have stayed high and everything.
Yeah.
So what's happening is these women, they'll tell you they want one thing, but if you offer them the other thing, they'll go for it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these women, they don't qualify for a masculine man. Most masculine men are already married in our early 20s. And we don't tend to get divorced. Because we just don't. We make it work because masculinity goes along with maturity, and maturity is what keeps marriages together.
Well, that's another huge marker of the decline of masculinity is the incline of broken marriages, of divorces, you know. And it's it's tragic to see now, but yeah, no, it's interesting that you mentioned that. So would you say that in your coaching work that one of if not the main subject that you're dealing with, whether you're speaking to men or women, is relationships and their relationship with the opposite sex, with the partner, if they have one? Is that the main kind of problem that you, which I know
that's what most people come to me for? Yes.
Is that something you specialize in, or would you say that is what most people who need coaching and look for coaching really want to talk about? Is that the main source of problems that you think are present in the world currently?
Yeah. So what happens if you're completely isolated by yourself? You can be immature and selfish, and you can be a real dick, and it doesn't matter because there's nobody there to feed you back some of that and say, hey, you know, you're not treating me well. But you get into a relationship, or you try to get into a relationship, and all of your incompleteness becomes fully revealed. And so it's when you're in relationships or trying to get into them, that you find out where you're lacking and where you need to improve. And so even though I'm really teaching them about how to think and how to be mature and how to process their emotions, the effect only is necessary when you're in a relationship. You know, you don't have to know how to parent until you have kids. There are things you don't need to know until you need to know them. And then, goodness, you need to know them. And so that is usually the trigger that causes people to come to me, is relationship connected. But it's not the cause. It's just the thing that allows them to see that. There's a reason why, in general, married men are more mature than single men, and married men with children are more mature than married men without kids, is because we're getting these different relationships. We have a relationship with our spouse, we have a relationship with our children, and that causes us to mature. And no doubt you've noticed this, that your children make all of your flaws and weaknesses more apparent to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and definitely. That's part of the reason, by the way, before you have kids, that your wife can be, women can be super annoying on purpose, in very much the same way that children are, is she's unintentionally, women don't know why they're doing this. What they're doing is they're trying to trigger those little flaws in us that we need to fix before we have kids, so that we're not blowing up at our kids.
Very, you know? Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
It's extremely adaptive, And it really only happens where there's long-term marriages. So you don't see this in every culture. You see this mostly in Western culture where there's that kind of shit testing. And what it is it's if we allow it, it will refine us and allow us to learn how to deal with the kind of immature things that kids do. So that means we got to be emotionally non-reactive to these shit tests. We have to understand why they're coming up. Why is a woman testing us? It's because there's an unknown. I don't know if this guy's going to stand up for me. So I'm going to poke him and see if he stands up for himself. If he doesn't stand up for himself to me, then he won't stand up for me to other people.
And it can be a real knock to the ego. Mm. You know, speaking yeah. personally, you know, when your wife rightly and kind of subconsciously tests you on these things, or yeah. your children do, you feel like your authority is being questioned. And I think it's how you react to that determines your success as a father and as a man, because you can see how someone who cannot accept having their authority apparently questioned like that. So rather than looking at themselves in the mirror and saying, okay, what do I need to do to deal with this situation better next time so that my child doesn't seem to question my authority again, what can I do to prevent or to fix that situation? Then you can see how some men, or you can almost understand how some men actually become violent towards their family, because they take it as a personal slight when their child or their spouse questions them in that way. So I think that that's another defining factor, a way of determining, you know, real men and real fathers from the failures, is in how you course correct after a situation yeah. like that.
Yeah. What is your level of control over your impulses? That's a really good measure for maturity. It pretty much is a one-to-one way of measuring that. If you can't control your impulses to react emotionally to things, then you need to work on that. And, you know, it's funny because I thought that I had everything nailed down. And I mean, I teach other people about it, but every once in a while, my kids will find a new button that I didn't know was there, and they'll find it and they'll push it over and over again until they get a reaction. And when everything's going great, it's easy to be in a relationship. It's easy to look after your kids. You know, people say, I looked after a kid for 2 hours one day and it was fine and I didn't get stressed out. Try doing that when your wife gave birth 3 months ago and you haven't slept yet since she gave birth, because you're looking after the older kids because she had a cesarean and she's completely out of it and had an infection and, you know, whatever other complications she had. And we don't have the kind of support system that we used to have. Our ancestors, men wouldn't have worried about any of that. We just went out to the field and worked. And the women looked after all of that. We don't even know how it happened. It just happened and, you know, we don't have to worry about it. But nowadays, it's not that easy. Mm. Now you've got to have emotional control.
Yeah. So
then it's tough. It's a real measure of your maturity as a man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, as I just mentioned, you know, is that, you know, the relationship problems between men and women, is that the main kind of problem we have in the modern age? And I think about, you know, through the Fergan and through, you know, other endeavors that I've been engaged with over the years, there are a lot of men, usually younger than me, who have had a lot of misfortune in relationships. You know, they're either single, still looking for a woman, or they're in a relationship but they don't think it's going anywhere. Maybe their partner doesn't want to have children and they think they've picked the wrong person and things like that. And most of these guys, how they explain this is they say that all of the fault is with women. Women have been ruined by Tinder and feminism and all of this kind of thing. And they say, you know, I must admit I am fortunate enough never to have experienced Tinder and hopefully never to experience Tinder. But the things I've heard about it sounds pretty horrific. But what a lot of these younger guys are saying is that, you know, women these days are so promiscuous and have such unrealistically high standards and view of themselves that a good looking guy can go on there and basically clean up. You know, they will get the attention of all of the women, and the women don't care that this guy that they've hooked up with on Tinder has already slept with five other women in the last fortnight. You know, they don't care about that. They're just that they think they deserve that guy because he's good looking and he's whatever, you know, they, so a lot of these young guys who are lamenting this situation are saying, I don't stand a chance because in a traditional society, my, you know, 40, 50 grand a year job and my, degree in whatever, and my upstanding citizenry, would guarantee me a good wife. But now, because of the way that the world is now, I don't get a look in. But as I say to these guys, and I'm pretty sure you'd agree with me here, and I'd be interested in your take on this, but if you were a masculine man, doesn't matter if you're not the best looking man in the room. If you're a masculine man, if you're making an effort to improve your physical appearance, your strength, your virility, your creative output, your confidence. And, you know, this is something not a lot of people realize, but you can enhance your confidence. You're not born with terminally low confidence. You know, I would consider myself naturally quite a guy with fairly low confidence, but I've, through various means over the years, I've taught myself to become more confident. So I can't help but look at these guys and think, you know, you think that the fault is entirely with women. I think that you still haven't tried all of the means at your disposal to become an attractive man to attract those women.
Yes, that's absolutely right. The thing is, I talk to the women. So these guys, they're guessing based on statistics, what's going on. And two things you have to remember. The statistics were calculated by your enemies who want to undermine your own faith in your ability and in your people's ability to survive. So they're going to tell you whatever bullshit helps them achieve their goals. Are the statistics correct or not? We don't know. I'm not going to trust them. I'm going to trust what women tell me that I talk to, and I'm a human lie detector. So I know when they're lying, and I'll point that out to them, and they'll often correct themselves a nice two or three times till I get to the truth. I dig down, and women tell me that they find men their age. This is women in their 20s. They find men their age incredibly immature, very, very boring, lacking in ambition. And they don't care if the guy, they don't care that the guy makes 50 grand a year. They care that he's okay with that. What they want is a guy who's got ambition and goes, this is where I am now, but I'm going places. I want to do something cool with my life. It doesn't even have to be money. It's just something that's not boring. Women need excitement. They're kind of like big children. And they need some sort of exciting narrative that you're going to take them on, some adventure. You know, they come to you and say, what have you got to offer? And you give them some autistic story about, you know, what your life is. And they're like, this is so boring. You know, I don't want to play video games with you. You know, I want to have some sort of an adventure. And their idea of what their adventure is what they're told. So they'll often say things like travel. You can give them a substitute adventure that's much more interesting.
Like having a family.
Yeah, having a family. You know, pretty much every single woman wants children, even the ones that say they don't. What they mean is, when a woman says, I don't want children, what she means is, I don't want children with you right now.
Yeah.
So either you need to improve yourself, or the right now part needs to change. Okay. So, you know, that might just mean she doesn't feel confident in your debt, in your dedication to a family or something like that. Or many, many times, the biggest thing holding women back from wanting kids, in my experience with talking to them, is that they feel that they're unqualified. Mm-hmm. It's not actually, it's partly the man, but it's mostly their own feeling of inadequacy. I ask a woman, how many children could you look after? Oh, one, maybe two, but I just don't think I can look after more than that. Meanwhile, my great-great-grandmother, she had like 16 kids, and so did all of her siblings. You know, they all had 10 plus kids, and they were fine with that. And they live in a cabin in the woods somewhere. So the women can do more than that, but these women weren't trained to be wives and mothers, so they have this lack of confidence.
Yeah.
If you have confidence and you go up to a woman and you say, you don't say it exactly like this, but here's my proposal for an awesome life. Come join me. And yeah. She says, I'm kind of scared of that. And I'm like, don't worry. I believe in you that you can do it. And, you know, you, if you have enough confidence that they're confident in your abilities, they'll also be confident in your judgment of their capacity to go along with you.
That's, you've frighteningly described my exact situation. This is how I came to have children. My wife was exactly like that. She wasn't confident in her ability. She didn't feel like, I said to her, do you envision yourself being a mother at some point in life? And she said, well, yeah, of course I do. I said, well, you know, you are of, you know, such an age. I think we were in our 20s at the time. I said, you know, late 20s. And I said, well, why delay it anymore? Because think about it. If we have our first child next year, then you're going to be, you know, like late 30s by the time they're 10, whatever, you know. And when I put it to her like that, and I expressed the fact that I knew I wanted children and I was ready to do it, and I thought that we should be doing it right now, then she realized that actually, yeah, this is what I need to do. And I agree, that's exactly, you need to go to your wife or your partner and say, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have children. We love each other. We're good people. We both envision ourselves being parents in the future. So we're going to do it now. Why wouldn't we do it now? Why would we keep delaying it until some, you know, nondescript time in the future? You know, so many of the, you know, of the guys I know who are in loving, stable relationships now, a lot of them, the guy wants children, the woman kind of does, kind of doesn't. And they can't get their partner to commit. She won't do it. And they've kind of resigned themselves to the fact that she's kind of just content never really having children, and that they're not going to force her to do it. But you need to put your foot down as a man. You need to say, no, I want children. You want children. So let's have children. You know, you can't let the woman keep kind of kicking the can down the road.
I told my wife, I'm going to have children. I'm married to you, so I hope it's with you. you know, but if for some reason you're really sure about this, and you know, you're really, this uncertainty you have continues, because it was uncertainty. This uncertainty you have continues, I will have to make other arrangements. And because there's no way I'm, you know, going to disrespect my ancestors by not having children.
Yeah.
That's just not going to be done. And so what ended up happening is, she never said anything different. She just, you know, you have unprotected sex, you're going to have kids. You know, you don't need her to say, yeah, I want to have kids.
You just need to, stop taking contraception.
Just need her to get pregnant, quit the contraception.
Yeah.
If she's on the pill, I'd get her off that as soon as possible. That stuff's hormonal birth control is terrible for women.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But if you're using any like time method or whatever of contraception, most of the time, see, you have to remember, part of it is that the vast majority of women do not want to take personal responsibility for anything, and especially big decisions like children. I talked to women and they basically say, I wish a guy could just clunk me on the head and take me off and I'd be his wife. I don't want to go through this dating process because I have to make too many decisions and take too much responsibility. I'd like some masculine man to just kidnap me and I'm his wife.
That scarily kind of describes not just women, but most men in the current civilization and their relationship.
Yes, unfortunately.
Their relationship to the state. They don't want the responsibility of like personal health or personal protection. So they outsource that to the state and say, roll their sleeves up and say, okay, you can jab me and you can take responsibility for my personal health.
Yeah. And women, if young, fertile women do that, that's fine. Although at some point, all women need to also grow up as well and take personal responsibility. But when men do it, then society crumbles because there's no adults left anymore. And the problem is they want the state to take responsibility for them, but they still somehow think they get a say in what happens.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
That's it. Yeah.
And then you have these elites at the top that go, well, they're all a bunch of children. We can't let them have a say. Let's pretend there's a democracy when there's not. And so we end up with kind of the situation we're in now. It's this everyone defending their interests, and the interest of so many people is to remain children.
Yeah. Don't, act like a child if you don't want to be treated like a child. It's really that simple.
Universal franchise where everyone votes is the biggest mistake the West ever did, because we should have continued to have demonstrated interest voting, where unless you have proof that you are competent, you don't get a say in those matters. And the UK had a great way of doing it, has a great way of doing it. We're separating the houses so that certain things were dealt with by people who had a say in it, and other things which those people had no say in were dealt with by other people. You know, it used to be that only the aristocracy went to war, so only the aristocracy dealt with things to do with military matters within their own subpart of the government. Nowadays, it's completely fallen apart with universal franchise, where you know you can be the most incompetent idiot in the world, but your vote counts the same as everybody else. And this is why things are falling apart, is we're have a society run by children.
Yeah. Well, I think that segues quite well into kind of the biggest topic that we wanted to get into. And we've been going for an hour already. But you wanted to talk about, and I'm always happy to talk about this, is the nature of the kind of the more cosmic nature of what we're facing today, particularly with what's happened over the last 3 years with regards to feminism and masculinity and, you know, the kind of upsetting of the traditional natural, you know, gender roles. So this idea that this is more of a spiritual war, that it's not something that can be combated on a political level or even a racial level or anything like that, but that it is a spiritual war. So I know that you had some points that you wanted to make on this. So what is it that you kind of, what would your response be to that idea, this spiritual war idea?
Yeah, it's a spiritual war, and it's interesting that they want us to focus on it being some religious, and then spiritual is not religious, that's the spirit of Western men that's under attack, not any church. In fact, most of the churches are part of the problem. It's not a political war or a racial war, but those are the places they want us to focus on. Not that those things have no connection, but those are downstream of the spiritual war. So they want us to be working on symptoms when we should be working on the root causes of the problem. Deep, deep in the problem is this spiritual war that we're in, is that we have completely lost our identity. We're disconnected from our heritage, even as individuals going back a generation or two in our family. Do you know your great-grandfather's name even? Most people don't. Many people don't today. Many people can't trace their ancestry back past their parents, practically. It's scary how little people are connected with their recent past. And because of this, they have no spiritual root, nothing to keep them stable. And this is ideal if you want to control a people. The only people in history that weren't allowed to have identities were generally slaves or thralls. You have these people that are enthralled, that are under your control. You can't let them have an identity, because if they have an identity, they can rise up against you. And so they've done this to us. They've taken away our identity of who we are as a people, and they've crushed that out of us. And in order to do that, they've created a society of children. So we're a very infantile society. However, only mature men and women can fight in a spiritual war, because it takes more maturity than you just need to survive. You know, different levels of maturity required for different things. And, historically, when we talk about something like a patriarchy, that's not rule of men. That's rule of the most wise and mature men in the society. And a patriarchy always came along with a matriarchy. They each ran their own areas. Sort of like I mentioned earlier, political houses being separate for their separate issues. The matriarchy was concerned with the things of women and children. And the patriarchy was concerned with the things of men and the regulation of the external, outside of the tribe, what was going on. It requires mature men and women to run our institutions. We don't have these. So what do? We import them.
Yeah.
UK doesn't even have enough mature men and women to be prime minister, apparently, to find a prime minister that's from your own ethnicity. You have to import one.
Yeah. I pay so little attention to that it may as well not even be an issue, to be honest with you, because precisely because I don't outsource my agency.
That's right.
To the government, I try to live as much as possible as though there is no government, basically. Mm-hmm. Which in a different time, I think wouldn't be the case. I'm not opposed to hierarchy. I'm not opposed to kingship. I'm not opposed to rules and laws and customs and things like that, except when they are hostile to the well-being of my folk. And yeah. I think one thing that I've been thinking about quite a lot recently is that every civilization has some kind of higher principle that it's working towards. And that can either be material, i.e. the economy. And that's how all Western nations are run today. All that you ever, if you tune into the news, which I haven't done in quite a while, but if you do, all you'll hear about is whether this is good for the economy, whether this is upholding economic growth. You know, this term economic growth is basically the mantra of modern civilization, whereas past civilizations, and you know, being a heathen myself, obviously I'm not in favor of Christianity, but at least under a non-secular Christian society, at least that higher principle that kind of bound society together was an immaterial one. It was a principle, it was a conviction, it was somewhat abstract, but not in the sense of being meaningless. You know, it was, there was a meaning to life that was beyond simply economic growth and things like that. And I think that's how we can see that this is a spiritual war, because everything, our entire, not just on an individual level, but our entire society has been boiled down to this materialist drive for economic growth or whatever. And that sucks.
It's the third function. In a democracy, the third function is 80% of the population, and so they have complete control in a democracy. When you have a proper trifunctional system, most of the long-term nation decision-making power rests in the 1% that is in the first function, that is primarily concerned with the long-term spiritual welfare of the people. And so they're making these decisions with thousands of years in view of you know, multiple generations and the history of their people in view. And then you have these second function people making the decisions about defense based on, you know, what's coming up in the next generation, who are they going to have to fight? Whereas when you have third function people making decisions, it's what's the next harvest? Mm-hmm. That's as far ahead as they think. And worse today, because nobody's having to think one harvest to the other. They're like one workday to the other. That's it. It's how far ahead as they think. This is why people eat in fast food, is because they don't think ahead and go shopping. So they don't have any food at home to cook. And so we have this like very short-term thinking society, and that hugely influences the decisions we're making. It's minimize pain in the moment at the cost of whatever happens in the future. Doesn't matter. And that's part of the spiritual warfare, is that's an immature mindset. The more mature you are, the longer a process you start thinking about. You start thinking farther into the future. And we, you know, even though pretty much all Europeans around today are descended from aristocracy because of plagues killing off most of the underclass over time, we still are thinking so much like this third function people in general. That it's scary. This is the third function wanted to be ruled by the first and second function because they understood that. The problem is now under a democracy, they're told that their interests, because they're in a majority, their interests are right, just because they're a majority. And this is a huge problem we're facing.
Would you say that the first function class has essentially been removed?
It's the first function class has been replaced by celebrities and supposed scientists and all these other things, these other religions. You know, we got the rainbow religion, we got the science as a religion, we have politics as a religion. These things have replaced the first function with false religions, basically.
I remember a few years ago, well, it was probably about 10 years ago now, having quite an in-depth discussion with my dad. You know, my dad and I have always got into some quite good, deep philosophical discussions. And, you know, I wasn't as well read as I am now, but I instinctively was arguing the case for monarchy, because I was saying, And this was just the result of a purely logical process for me. I was saying, what we have with rule by parliament is we have rule by politicians. So politicians are people who aren't necessarily first function people. They're fleeting. They can come in as a career politician or as someone who had an interest in some area of business and then decided to become a politician. All they're really interested in is they're in the UK. We have a, you know, they have a 4-year term typically in well, they're, the, you know, the government has 4 years in the seat of so-called power, and that's it. So most of these politicians, that's all they're thinking is 4 years ahead. And I mean, who remembers, you know, the Secretary of Defense from, you know, 20 years ago? Who remembers the Health Secretary from even 8 years ago? Hardly anyone. I mean, certainly the majority of people have no idea who they were. So these politicians have been able to insert themselves into positions of power or be inserted into positions of apparent power, certainly of influence. You know, they're in my belief playing a role, but nevertheless they've found themselves in that position. They only need to be concerned about the next 4 years or so, and then they can retire with a big fat paycheck, whatever. They can get a job, they can have a share in a company making, I don't know, weapons for war, whatever, you know, and they'll be forgotten. A king or a queen doesn't have that luxury. They're part of a dynasty, they're part of a continuation, and they can't think just 4 years ahead. They can't even just think for their lifetime. They need to think about the following lifetimes. Even if they're not a particularly scrupulous person, they still realize that the mistakes they make now will probably come back to haunt them in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, or their children. So even if they don't care about the nation as a whole, they certainly do care about their progeny. And that was my argument for monarchy as a form of leadership or governance, really. And I think that kind of, in a somewhat immature way, describes the difference between first function-led societies and what we have now.
Also, when you petition a king for redress of your injuries, as the law permits, you're petitioning an actual individual, an existing. So you're petitioning the king in sense that he's an institution as well, but you're petitioning something that's really there. When you petition a government, are any of those people the same one that were there last year when the problem was created? No, and they'll just blame somebody else.
Yeah,
it makes them like jello. You know, you there's no substance there. It's there, but you can't do anything with it. There's no substance. There's nothing to attack and nothing to deal with. And this slipperiness is intentional. It's so they can avoid all responsibility. Not only that, when you have, you know, there was division of responsibility and power as well. And this division of responsibility and power creates more freedom than you get in the current situation where nobody really has any power. Yeah, there is no real power. The power is all in the hands of people where it stays permanently, and everyone else, they just change seats in front of them. And so the people who really have the power don't change very much. Now, the other
thing
is,
and there's no expectation of power, is there? It's like what we have with the situation in the West, is that, you know, everybody sees that they have thrust before them the images of illegal migrants coming into the country. Mm-hmm. And you'll have every consecutive government will say, we don't have the power to stop this. Yeah. And it doesn't matter whether you know that that's bullshit or not. It doesn't matter whether you think that's a lie or not. The fact is they're able to say that, and no one is able to pull them up on it. No one's able to question them on it. So as you say, it's this expectation of power that's been removed, so that we no longer expect certain demand certain things of those who govern us.
Well, the other thing too with a king is that a king is a father. That's what it really means. You're the father of your nation, not just the king. And when you're acting in that role as a father, your job is to protect your people in your country. Mm-hmm. And what happens to other people in their country is not your responsibility any more than what happens to my neighbor's kid is not my responsibility. Yes, I don't want anything bad to happen to them. you know, and I will take action to protect my neighbor and his kids, but not at the cost of my own children.
And yeah, and by the way, that plays out etymologically as well. The word king comes from kunning, which means kuning, belonging to the kin. So the suffix in Old English ing means belonging to, which is why you have like the city name Birmingham. Birmingham is the place of the people belonging to Burma, Birmingham, and it's the same with kinning. The king is the person who belongs to his kin. So it's his responsibility is to his folk. He belongs to that particular folk. It's not to all faiths, as the current king of England says. He's not a traditionally speaking, the king upheld one faith, one society, one set of customs, one set of laws, and one ethnic group, essentially, until, you know, they became a bit expansionist and they tried to cover several, but they were always closely related ethnic groups.
Yes, and the other thing that goes along with that is, as a father, you want to see, you want to rule over a nation of mature people. There's a lot less cost to ruling a mature people. They pretty much rule themselves.
Yeah.
There's a lot less work there. There's less opportunity for graft and theft and corruption. But if you are thinking in the long term, you don't want to do any of those things, because none of those things are good for the long term of your nation. You're going to leave your child or your grandchild with a problem that you've created. And since you're no longer incentivized to prey on the people, you want the people to be as strong as possible so no one else can prey on them either. And so we see throughout Western history, generally, an encouragement for men to grow up and be men. We have institutions designed to let men grow up. We see in the pre-Christian times, there was a lot of institutions young men would join, and the purpose was to take them from early adolescence through to being a man. And either you made it through it or you died. You know, there wasn't much in the way of failing this. So we had very few adult males that were undeveloped, that were incapable of pulling their weight, because nobody wants a man around that can't pull his weight. And so you'd be a slave, or you'd be out of society.
That's when you have a king who doesn't want to micromanage the people that he is deigned to protect or to look out for. What we have now, they actually seek immature people for society now, because our immaturity gives them the justification for greater control and micromanaging of our lives, which is currently what they seek with this emerging technocratic society, where they want to very specifically tell human beings how to live and to change our natural customs and instincts into something far less natural.
And it all comes back, it relies on the immaturity. So in the main factor that matures men, especially, let's deal with men particularly. If we fix men, they'll fix the women in their lives. That's how it always works. The women will follow the men, the strong men. They always do. If we can fix men, we fix society. How do we do that? It's the underfathering. That doesn't mean that they have no father. It means that their father is not truly a man or in some way capable of teaching them what they need to know. We have this underfathered generations now. It's been a couple of them. And that's what we need to address. And there are very few men capable of fathering their own children properly. Let's say it's 10% of men. Well, let's say that 10% of men say, okay, right now you've got little kids. Maybe you don't want to mentor a lot of people. So you mentor one or two young men. And every mature man was to mentor one or two young men for 2 or 3 years. And that was something he did as a duty to his society. And you might say, why am I going to invest in someone else's kids? Well, because one day your children and them are going to live together. And do you want your children to have to deal with a society of children? Or do you want them to have a society of adults to be a part of? It's what society you're leaving your children. So if every mature man was to pick a young man or two to mentor, and he had an idea of how to take him through that process of helping him become a man, And then every one of those men that were mentored in turn did that. Mm. We'd fix this in a couple of generations. This is the spiritual version of what they did in the Iberian Peninsula when they reconquered it from the Moors. They started in the north and they just went city by city. Every few years, they'd gather enough strength up to take another city over. They'd fill it with new inhabitants. They'd fortify the area. And there, this is our new frontier. We're not backing an inch behind this. And it took 700 years to reconquer. Portugal's not a big country in Spain. They're not big countries. It took 700 years to reconquer them because they did this bit by bit because they were outnumbered. The enemy had more numbers, more wealth, more contacts. They had better politically aligned, and they still beat them because they did it incrementally and they would not back down from the areas they'd already conquered. We can do the same thing, but we're not fighting for soil. We're fighting for the hearts of men.
And that sort of patience that is required for that kind of, that drawn out war of attrition almost is a masculine trait, right?
Yes, absolutely. There's a great book that's almost impossible to find. It's out of print, but you can find it in PDF. It's called A Culture Made for War, I think is what it's called. And it's about the Portuguese and Spanish cultures that were redoing this. Can you imagine living in a city with 40,000 other men? There's not a woman in the city. The women weren't allowed in the frontier area because it was too dangerous. And also you stick one woman in with all of those men and every man gets 10% softer. It's just the way it is. We're more gentle around women. So you'd be in this place. And if you were a young man, that was where the opportunity was. You're 12, you run away from home because you're like, I'm joining the frontier. And you'd go there and you'd get some job and someone would say, hey, we're going to go make a raid. And you'd grab your rake or your stick or whatever it was. And you'd go follow them up and try to loot whatever you could loot. Maybe you'd make your fortune that way. A lot of young men made their fortune just going out, borrowed, rented weapons, going out and raiding the local Muslim towns and collecting up their loot. And eventually they became wealthy and bought better weapons and equipment and would have a whole gang with them. And some of them entered into the nobility by doing this. They worked their way up. Sometimes it took a couple of generations.
Yeah,
but it's a very viable strategy for what we're doing.
Yeah, and a very important message, really, a very important story to learn from, something I need to learn more about myself, actually. But one thing that kind of does strike me, if we talk about this idea of mentorship that would have occurred more naturally in the past, where I see it happen most often now, naturally, is in subcultures. So, I think back to the kind of less sub of the cultures that I can think of is the Boy Scouts. I was a scout when I was younger, and you'd have the Arkela, the leader or whatever, or the scout leader, but there'd always be some older boys who had already been through Beavers, Cubs, and Scouts, as we have in Britain, but they, for whatever reason, they stuck around, and I think one of the reasons was this very altruistic desire to help younger men, boys come through the ranks in the same way that they did. And I also see this with people I know from the punk and metal scenes. They talk about how when they first got into that music, there was an older guy, this like old punk or old metalhead who was 20 years older than them and introduced them to all of these great new bands and used to copy cassettes for them and, take them to shows and things like that. And those guys often, they begun as kind of more just like a cultural mentor, just helping you get into the music or whatever, but they would actually essentially fulfill the role of the father. They would actually give the kind of life lessons that the father had failed to give. So I think from that point, that perspective, subcultures are incredibly important in the modern age because they do seem to offer a place where those natural roles can be, fulfilled.
Yeah, it's basically the way of men is the way of the gang. That's what Jack Donovan says. And those are forms of gangs. We associate gangs with criminal culture today. That's not what it means. It just means a group, basically. And a gang of men is a group of men who are gathered together for mutual protection and for some objective, whatever that happens to be. Now, if you're a man and you're interested in mentoring other men, you have two choices. You can go find a group, join it, and say, hey, I'm here. I want to help young men. Or you can create your own. And it can be based around anything. You know, you're a retired carpenter. Go put out there that you want to teach a couple of young guys how to be carpenters. Yeah. And go teach them how to do it. Work slow. Work the hours you want. Don't make it too hard on yourself. But, you know, you spend a couple hours a week with these guys for 2 or 3 years, they're going to learn a skill from you. More importantly, they're going to learn how to be men.
It's really funny that you mentioned that, actually, because I'm not an established coach such as yourself, but I have had a couple of guys younger than me come to me privately, send me emails or whatever and say, look, you know, I'm trying to kind of work towards the kind of lifestyle that you have, you know, and I don't have the perfect life, but I've got a wife, I've got children, we're homesteading, homeschooling, you know, all of that good stuff. We're practicing our native folk faith and things. So a lot of, you know, and it's taken a lot of work and sacrifice to get to this point in my life. And I guess a lot of younger guys kind of see what I've done and they want to know how I achieved it. So they've kind of come to me. So I have actually been coaching, you know, a couple of guys younger than myself. And one of them, funnily enough, is looking for a carpentry apprenticeship. I've been trying to, he's already got the right ideas. He knows what he wants and everything like this. And it's, I've been trying to do my best to help him achieve that. But apprenticeships, I think, are a really important and understated aspect of what we need to do moving forward. We need to make open those positions so that skills can be passed down more easily to young men, not just so that those skills are changing hands between generations, but also so that the relationships between older men and younger men and the kind of peripheral mentoring ideas and ideals and you know, kind of fatherly you know, sharings and instincts can come across as well. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I think apprenticeships are a really important thing, and I really do hope that more men, particularly of older generations, do look to pass down their skills in that way.
Yeah, and when you think about it, you can do it for altruistic reasons, or you can think of it like this. So I have three sons. Maybe I will have more kids one day. But if I have no more, I have many men and a bunch of women that I have helped and mentored to a point where basically I helped them become adults. These are people that will never be out of my life. They'll always be in some way in my life. They're like spiritual children. Mm-hmm. But these people are mostly, I've done this online. If you're doing this in your local community and you're a man and you're, say, your 40s, 30s, 40s, in your 30s, you can start mentoring like, it's really serious mentoring. The reality is you can mentor anyone 4 years younger than you. They're just one step behind you. Teach them to get to where you are. And then tell them, hey, I don't got anything more to teach you, or go learn something new. And then you can teach them. That gets you getting mentored as well. But you spend 10 years mentoring guys and you got 20, 30 young guys that you've mentored that you trust. And now there's a breakdown of society. What have you got? You've got your war band.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your little group of men that are going to help pacify and keep things calm in your neighborhood. When I was a kid, I was able to make that little school gang, not because I just said, hey, who wants to make a gang? It's because I'd already cultivated relationships. I had gotten into fights to pull other kids out who were getting beat up. They owed me one.
You're killing two birds with one stone. You're mentoring, yes, and tribe building at the same time. Yeah, yes. I've not thought of it, yes, that way.
That is the best way. The best way to build a tribe is to have 20 kids. But you know, the second best way to build a tribe is to have a bunch of spiritual children, mm-hmm, and to help them to achieve manhood. And when I coach people, I'm very clear that I'm coaching you, but it doesn't end when we're done. You now have to pass this on. You have a responsibility to pass the things I've taught you on. That's part of how you pay for this, is by passing it on. And certainly if you're receiving coaching for free. Now, here's the other thing. I don't think anyone should get mentorship or coaching for free. Yes, maybe there's no money changing hands, But there is a law of reciprocity in nature where you do not take without giving back. And so there needs to be an expectation of giving back. Generally, you know, if you have a mentor, I'm looking to buy a place in the countryside and have a hobby farm. And I want to put a bunkhouse there where I can have 10 or 20 guys, young guys. You want to come and stay there for a couple of months? You can. I'm going to work you. You're going to be a farm animal. You're going to be plowing and you're going to be digging fence holes and you're going to be doing stuff. But on the other hand, you're also going to get some mentorship and some help and some skill building and stuff like that. Whatever it is that you do, make sure that you give them the opportunity to pay you back in some way. Otherwise, you're actually hurting the person you mentor. It's very important that the mentee has an opportunity to pay back the mentor, or they feel infantilized, like they were some child receiving, you know, candy handouts. They have to feel like a man. They have to pay back their debts.
Yeah, it's also not a good life lesson to teach people that they can get anything for free.
Yes. Well, and the reason that men have to do this is because it's the only way that we create more men. You can't learn to be a man from a book. You can learn information that helps you to be more masculine, but you can't learn to be a man from a book. You can't learn to be a man from a woman. And for many young men, they only have women in their life, their mother, their school teachers, and most single mothers only have other single mothers around. The only men that hang around single mothers generally are the kind of men you don't want around children. And so these young guys, they don't have anyone else. It's either we're going to help them learn to be men or they're going to be permanently lost. And the younger we help them, you know, get them in 17, 18 years old and start helping them, they're going to prevent them from going in a lot of bad directions and wasting a decade of their youth.
Noah, there's one other thing that I wanted to pick your brain on, and that's the idea of AI coaching. So a bit of a hot topic on the Fergan in recent weeks has been this this rise of AI media tools. You know, we have AI art creation, even music creation, copywriting, stuff like this. As someone who does design work as a day job, this concerns me because I can see a time in the next few years where a lot of clients will go straight to AI for, you know, cheap design work, essentially. Now, Hadrian and I have discussed this quite a lot, and we did an episode on it called was it Man versus Machine? And we privately we've talked about what areas are there, what professional areas are there that are going to remain hopefully untouched by AI. And actually we thought that coaching would be one of them, because why would anyone who's suffering from the kind of the problems of the modern age want advice from a machine, which is a representative of these modern ills? Yet the other day on Red Ice, I came across a video where there's a website, I believe it's called Replica with a K, and this website is actually advertising like AI friendship tools. You know, you can have an AI friend as well as these other things. And one of the things that's advertising is AI coaching, you know, those specific words. So what do you think more broadly about this threat of AI tools or machine taught tools? And do you think it will have any kind of impact on, you know, this, what we've been talking about in this episode, the idea of mentoring and coaching?
I think that the AI tools will be very useful for coaching in certain domains. So they'll be useful for coaching people, say, I want to improve my marketing for my website. And they're going to say, well, you know, let me take a look. And it'll, you know, you give it your website URL and it'll say, okay, this part you're doing well. I can see you've spent this much on ads or whatever. And they're going to tell you that statistically you'll make more money if you reorganize things this way. And they'll optimize your website, that kind of stuff. I think that's going to be, I don't know why that doesn't already exist. I'm pretty sure that technology exists. No one's just hooked it together yet, because that's fairly simple. And all those statistics are well known. But humans aren't numbers. And when it comes to messing around inside of our head, it's a lot more complex than what a computer can do, because a big part of the coaching is trusting the coach. There's a reason that most mentorship with men happens while you're doing something. This is why I suggest, you know, coaching while you're, you know, teaching them something, martial arts, woodworking, whatever it is, because you do things together, you demonstrate competence, and that demonstration and competence gives you trustability. Yeah. So I see that you're not just competent at, like, if you show you're competent at doing something in woodworking, that doesn't mean you have woodworking skills. That also means that you have the patience to have developed them. You have the emotional control to go through the process of building it, and you can think. You know, you want to build a complex cabinet. So a lot of thinking goes. I've seen guys do it without a plan. Everything is in their head, and they just go in through the whole thing. That takes a certain competence. And so now you're going to trust this guy. This guy is good at something. Means he's got the ability to be good at other things. So I'm going to listen to him. Or, you know, this guy's got a happy wife and some kids, and everything is going good in his life. And I think, you know, that's what I want for me. So I'm going to ask him how he did it. What am I going to ask a computer? How, like, you know, are you married? No, I'm not even human. I don't want what you've got. Why would I ask you questions? And so, you know, I'm going to ask the computer questions about another computer. That's what the website question is. I'm not going to ask the computer a question about me. There's the trust issue is huge. Now, here's the other thing. If you took, say, all my work and fed it in as the raw material, I'd say not just my work, but the work of the top, say, 20 coaches in the world. And then you started to get responses out of that. All it does is it takes canned responses from one or the other of us and gives it to you. It's just a quick lookup tool to find that person's information. It's Google on steroids. It's not as intelligent as people think. And so I don't think it will be replaced. Now, here's where I think it'll be useful for coaches. I'm a human lie detector, so I can tell when people are lying. I can tell when they're hiding things. I can tell their emotional state, even when they're hiding it. And I'm very good at that. And that helps me being a coach. I'm very intuitive with that. And I always have been since I was a child. I could read people. I think I was better at it as a kid in some ways, because now I turn it off on purpose because it's too revealing of the person, and it's like being naked and it makes people uncomfortable. So I turn it off a lot. But I think there'll be apps where you're doing a video conference and it says micro expressions indicate lying. Micro expressions indicate heightened level of stress. And as a coach, you're going to be able to look at that and say, I'm pushing too hard, or no, I'm pushing on the right spot. This is where the pain is. This is what we need to discuss.
You know,
and so it's going to give some intuition to those coaches.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of the Voight-Kampff test at the beginning of Blade Runner, which is happens to be a favorite film of mine. And when they're asking questions of the supposed replicants, you know, the non-humans, they're not necessarily looking for them to trip up in answering the questions. They're looking at their reaction when they kind of question their answer to the questions. You know, I think it's one of the replicants is asked, you see a turtle on its back in the desert and you're not turning it over. Why are you not turning it over? And then he kind of, starts to malfunction because it's the inability to react emotionally properly to that question. But I would say that I have a slightly different view from you. I'm not currently in the camp of people who thinks that we should be using AI tools to our advantage. And the reason for that is because, you know, you gave the example of website marketing, and absolutely, I can see that being one of the first apparently useful tools that will come out, you know, something that will tell you it precisely how to make your website more marketable and more efficient and things like that. But there are such things as human marketers out there who are going to lose their jobs to that tool, in the same way that a designer like myself will lose work to AI design and illustration tools. Also, you know, there is this, people seem to have this idea that all technology is voluntary. Like you can take it or leave it. And, you know, when I used, because I've always been kind of a Luddite when it comes to smartphones. I've never owned one. Well, I have owned one, but I've never used one and taken out with me in the same way that most people do. And people have always said, oh, well, why does it matter? You either use it or you don't. You know, I've got a smartphone, but I don't need it all the time and things like that. I recently found that I couldn't open a new bank account without having a smartphone. And I actually had to borrow my wife's smartphone just to open a bank account. You know, so all these technologies, they start off as kind of, you know, they kind of start off as a bit of fun. There's some fun apps, some fun games, and then, oh, there's a communication tool. And
well, here's the thing. If you have a discussion with me in coaching, it's secret. No one ever knows. If you don't want me to take notes, I won't even take notes. I only take notes so that in the future, when I talk to you, I don't talk to you about the exact same thing again. You know, I progress to the next stage of what we're doing. If you talk to any of these AI programs, the way that they grow is by recording every question that's asked to them forever. And that will be able to be traced back to you. And now we live in this age, you know, I've had a number of Americans reach out to me for coaching because they said, if I talk about the problems I'm having to a therapist in the US, they'll take away my guns. Yeah. Or one lady says, they'll take away my kids. She says, I don't really want to harm myself, but I don't want to have a frank discussion about what happens if I get to that point with someone who's a therapist here, because I might end up institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And then there was no reason to institutionalize this person. They didn't deserve it, but they could have ended up there. Deserving it doesn't really matter. These AI programs will have no judgment. They will report you for anything you do, any wrong think, anything you do that's outside of what's acceptable behavior. And so I think, yeah, I bet you if there is AI coaching and AI therapy, it'll be free, subsidized by the state simply to collect information on you.
Yeah.
Much the same way that Google is free right now.
Yeah. Facebook and yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, all absolutely. The other social media.
And therein lies, you know, the importance of what Noah just said about being able to trust your coach or mentor. And I would say that that is hands down the most important factor in how you kind of choose your coach or mentor. That, you know, nothing else works unless you trust them.
Yeah, they need to have a kind of life that you might want to live, or a competency in the areas that you need help in. And you need to be able to trust them. And this is a big problem in, you mentioned the manosphere at the beginning, that there are a lot of grifter type people in the manosphere. This is a continual problem. They get exposed. Some of them get exposed, some don't. And so you need to really watch what that person's doing. Go look at their videos. Ask yourself, is this person solving problems or are they whining? And do I trust them? Almost every client I get has watched most of my videos, or at least dozens of them. Many of them have read one of my books. Well, no, they've read the book that I have that's public. I wrote a book on protecting yourself from manipulation. And this allows them to have a level of confidence in what I'm doing. Usually I ask, one of my intake questions is, why did you come and talk to me? And one of the things I'm hearing back from people is they say that, you seem like you will be kind to me. You know, they don't want someone that's going to be harsh or degrading to them, but you also seem like you're going to be very strict. And that's what we need out of good mentors and coaches. We need that good father, who is kind, but won't put up with your shit. You know, he's going to be kind, but he's going to make you do your homework, and you're going to learn your lesson. You're going to get what you need out of it.
Yeah.
Most of us are pretty good at making excuses for ourselves. And so if we don't have a mentor that has that backbone as well, then we're never going to make any progress. That's what happens in therapy. You just talk and talk, because most therapists are so effeminate that they won't stand up to you and let you know when you're your own worst enemy. And this is a big part of the reason why people get bogged down in these permanent talk fests on therapy. Doesn't happen if you have a good coach.
Yeah. And it seems to me that one of the other differences between therapy and coaching is that therapists identify problems, but don't show you how to solve those problems. Whereas coaches, the main goal is, right, you know, that I imagine that's what you focus on, is how to solve the problems. That, you know, identifying the problems is just kind of, you know, that's part of a necessary part of the process. But what you really want to get to is how to solve those problems.
Absolutely. And what I really think about is that I'm teaching people systems for thinking so that we don't just solve the problem they came to me with, but they now have a tool to solve all problems in that genre. So if it's an emotional problem, I'm going to teach you how to deal with emotions so that any other emotional problem you come up with in the future, you can deal with. Well, a lot of people, they have problems that are truly just personality things. And in therapy, they often say your personality is immutable. It just is what it is. But all of us know this isn't true because we know people whose personality has changed, usually for the worse. That's usually what happens. If you can change for the worse, you can change for the better.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to know how. Are you in control of that process, or are you a product of the random happenstance of your situation? And that's what I do. I'll put you in control of that process. If you're too neurotic, and your neuroticism is being prone to negative emotion, if you're too prone to being anxious and worry and stress, I'm going to teach you how to think differently. Yeah. And then you're no longer prone to those things. You're going to perceive the world differently because your thought processes are going to be different. There are a few therapists that do something similar to this. But generally, like I said, they work with broken people. It's the equivalent of going to the doctor because your leg is broken. Okay, so the doctor is supposed to reset your leg and put you in a cast and send you off. Whereas you go to a therapist or a coach and you say, "Hey, I want to get great at deadlifting," and they're gonna treat you. You wouldn't go to the coach with a broken leg and say, "Hey, can you help me get great at deadlifting?" He's gonna say, "No, you got to go to a therapist, fix that broken leg, and in some weeks when you're better, you can come back here and I'll teach you how to work out."
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's a great kind of note to end on, just kind of as an outro to this episode. You know, and I know that Noah obviously offers a service, and I've been very kind of mindful about not wanting this episode to be some kind of infomercial. And I've kind of, you know, in the time that I've been speaking with Noah, I've come to realize that, unfortunately, we live in a world where this kind of mentoring and coaching is vitally important. I think we downplay how important it actually is. And the fact of the matter is, no one can afford to give, a 40-hour week away for free. So obviously there is a cost that comes with things like coaching, but I would say probably invariably it is a cost worth paying for most people. If you've got serious problems that you're looking for help with, from someone like Noah, or even from someone like myself, who could probably offer a more kind of heathen specific angle on these same kind of services, then you can't really put a price on the quality of life that can come from that kind of thing. So yeah, it's one of those things. It's, I'm terrible at business. I'm terrible with my design work, and undercharging people and things like that. So I hate kind of monetizing things that are so vitally important as this. And, maybe hopefully a lot of people listening to this episode will have come away with a lot of free advice, that they can put into action. And there'll be no need for them to approach someone like Noah for further help. But if you do feel like you could do with further help, I know that Noah does help a lot of people. So you can go to his website, noahrevoy.com. What else, Noah? You've got a book, Become Immune to Manipulation. Is that the only public book you've got available?
That's the only book. Yeah, it's the only public book I have. I wrote this one because I was seeing that the heart of what was going on in society is that we're being manipulated. And I had to pick an area. I couldn't teach everyone high levels of agency. I don't think everyone is capable of learning that, but we're all capable of figuring out when we're being lied to and when someone's trying to trick us and fool us. And my goal is that through a book, this is also, you can buy a book for $10 if it's Kindle and $15, I think, if it's a paperback. It's a very cheap way to educate a lot of people, to protect them against manipulation, so that we have a society that says, "Hey, wait a minute, you're lying to me." Maybe they don't know what the truth is, mm-hmm. but they at least can identify the lies and reject them. And we do that long enough, and they're going to have to start serving up some truth to us. So that's my goal with this book. I go through it step by step, showing you how to identify manipulation and how to counter it. whether it's, you know, from your mother-in-law or from the state or from marketing or from your work, whatever it happens to come through.
And that's all we really needed over the last 3 years, wasn't it? We didn't need everyone to have the answers as to why this whole COVID psyop was happening. We just needed people to at least have the instinct to know that they were being lied to so that they could dig deeper. You know, that's my only criticism is not that people didn't have all the answers. And, you know, people who were at odds with me have said to me, oh, you didn't know what was going on. You said this would happen and this hasn't happened. And I said, well, yeah, okay, fair enough. But at least I knew that I was being lied to. You know, I may not have known exactly 100% why. I think my track record's been pretty good, but I may not have known exactly why, but at least I knew that I was being lied to. So yeah, I think that's an important skill to teach. So yeah, I'll be interested to have a read of that book myself as well. But yeah, any final words, Noah?
Yeah, whether you get mentorship or coaching from myself or someone else, if you're a young guy, get out there and look for it. Look for mature men in your community and let them know they're needed. I've talked to a lot of mature guys that would make wonderful mentors. And I said, hey, why don't you go mentor some young guys? And they answer, they say, what have I got to offer? I don't know. What am I going to tell them? And I said, literally anything, to let them ask you questions and answer them the way you would if your son asked you. And so you can get out there and you can tell these older men that we value you. Your opinions are useful for us. We need to know what you already know. And, you know, yeah, boomer this and boomer that. And a lot of them are, head in the sand boomers. So don't go to those guys. Go find some guys that didn't go through that. Some guys that had to make it on their own, you know, or even go and look and pick the wisdom you can out from those boomers.
Yeah.
They do have some things right. They're not complete idiots. Figure out what they've got, use what you can. And in turn, if you're a young man or even a middle-aged man and you want to mentor, don't think just because you're young, you can't mentor anyone. Go mentor a man. If you're 20, go mentor a 16-year-old. Help him get through the last couple of years of his high school. Make sure that he, you know, doesn't get led astray, doesn't get in trouble, doesn't get some girl pregnant or whatever it is. Go help out some younger guy. And if you're 16, go help out some 12-year-old. Everybody mentoring someone 4 or 5 years younger than them, that creates this chain of wisdom that we used to have. We had this chain of wisdom for 5,000 years, probably longer than that, probably went back to the Stone Age, that passed this wisdom on, and it broke in the world wars. We have to reestablish that, or we will not have a culture again.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem is you've just identified there is that men of different ages are reluctant to approach one another. So an older man is reluctant to approach a younger man and to offer him advice. Most of the time when I've seen that, it's been at the gym, you know, when I've been a young guy in my early 20s or whatever, and I've been lifting weights, and an older guy who clearly knows much better what he's doing, knows how to perform that movement with better form, you know, has come up to me and said, you know, hey, you know, just wanted to offer you some advice on this. And you need to be open to that. And you can, you know, as a young man with an ego, you can feel like your ability is being undermined by this cocky old man. But young guys need to be open to that. And most of the time, I think that there is no issue. Most of the time, young men are open to being given advice by older men, and older men are open to being asked for advice by younger men. But it so rarely happens. So yeah, I would just encourage anyone listening to this who, if you think that you have something to offer the younger generations, approach them. If you see people, you know, and you think that you can help them with something, approach them and offer your help voluntarily. You know, if they reject you with some kind of arrogant remark, then they weren't worth your time anyway. Likewise, if you're a young man and you're looking for help and you don't feel that your father is able to offer that help, you know, or maybe you're estranged from your father or whatever, you know, go to those older men and ask them. There's no shame in that whatsoever.
Yeah, that's the real solution. I can't coach everybody. No. You know, I make a living coaching. I take maximum 2-3 clients a month. That's not going to change the world by itself. It's all of those other men that are out there mentoring in their spare time. That in aggregate is what will change the world. Yeah. That is our solution. That's a solution I'm offering and suggesting that every man participates in, both as a mentor and the mentee. You can be mentoring a younger guy and get mentored by an older man. Heck, if you're 50, go find an 80-year-old and get mentored. You know, get his help on understanding how to enjoy your retirement when that happens one day, if that ever happens, given the current economy.
You don't have to know everything and have all the answers to consider yourself worthy of mentoring someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, and that really was what society was in the past, was that horizontal, vertical connection between older and younger men that passed on the wisdom of our ancestors. And we can restore it again. That's something that's in our power. We don't have to wait for someone else to do it. We can do it immediately.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Noah. It's been a great conversation. Really good to talk to you. Thank you for sharing your experience, your ideas, your wisdom with us. And hopefully everyone out there listening has got something, some food for thought, at least, out of this episode. And thank you, Noah. It's been good to speak to you, and let's stay in touch. Yeah.
Awesome. Looking forward to it.
Well, that was a slight tangent from speaking more explicitly about heathenry and spiritual matters. But as far as I'm concerned, what Noah and I discussed there was very applicable and pertinent to our modern struggle. And as this podcast is all about meeting the modern world and its challenges from with a heathen mindset, with a pagan mindset, and with that perspective, I do feel it's important to address these kinds of issues about relationships and the nature of what it is to be a man, what it is to be a family man, a father, a husband, and to have an impact on the community around you in a traditional fatherly masculine way. So for the riddle section at the end, last episode was number 27, and the answer to that one, the accepted answer to that one, is mead. And I suppose I didn't guess that one right myself, but when I look back over that riddle, you have lines like during each day corbiculars brought me through the bright sky. And I actually had to look up what a corbicula is, and the corbicula is the part of the hind legs of bees which carries the pollen. So that's the kind of, that is the reference in the riddle to bees, and to the fact that it is related to what bees produce. And then you have lines like, I was taken by men and bathed in a tub. Now I bind and I chasten them and cast a young man at once to the ground, and sometimes an old one too. And of course there it's talking about the alcoholic effects of mead and how the strength of that can often not be met by men, young or old. So yeah, that one was mead. So riddle number 28 for this episode, number 28, goes as follows. Some acres of this middle earth are handsomely attired with the hardest, sharpest, most bitter of man's fine belongings. It is cut, threshed, couched, kilned, mashed, strained, sparged, yeasted, covered, racked, and carried far to the doors of men. A quickening delight lies in this treasure, lingers and lasts for men who, from experience, indulge their inclinations and don't rail against them. And then, after death, it begins to gab, to gossip recklessly. Shrewd men must think carefully what this creature is. So give that one a go, and leave in the comments if you think you know the answer to that riddle. I can't say anything comes to my mind at this moment, but we'll discuss the answer to that one in the next episode of the Fergan podcast. So I thank all of you for listening to this one, and I'll speak to you again in the next one.